"Have you been on television before?" she asked.
I got the impression that she was being slightly more reserved with me. I expect she felt awed by the Führer's aura. "On several occasions," I said, "but rather a long time ago now."
"Right," she said.
"Might I have seen you in something before?" "I don't think so," I said. "It was also here in Berlin, at the Olympic Stadium."
"Were you the warm-up for Mario Barth?"
"What?" I asked, but she seemed no longer to be listening.
"You caught my attention straight away. That skit of yours was brilliant. I think it's amazing that you put it all together yourself.
But you'll be doing something different now, won't you?"
"Something quite different," I said hesitantly. "The time for games is long past."
"Here we are," Fräulein Jenny said, opening a door behind which was a makeup table. "I'm going to leave you in the hands of Elke. Elke, this is, Uncle Rolf."
"Wolf," I corrected her. "Uncle Wolf."
Elke, a tidy-looking woman of around 40, knitted her brow, looked at me, and then at a note that lay next to her cosmetics.
"Ooh, I can't see any wolf here. My list says I should have Hitler now."
She smiled. Then she offered me her hand and said,
"My name's Elke. What's yours, darling?"
Here, once more, was the familiar comradeship of the trenches, although Frau Elke seemed a little too old for Uncle Wolf, so I settled for Herr Hitler.
"Right then, Herr Hitler," Frau Elke said. "Take a seat, sweetheart. Any special requests, or should I just do as I see fit?"
"I have full confidence in you," I said, sitting down. "After all, I cannot attend to everything myself."
"You're not wrong,"
Frau Elke said, putting a smock over me to protect my uniform. Then she examined my face.
"You've got fabulous skin, babe,"
she said, reaching for a powder compact.
"Many people of your age just don't drink enough. You should see the complexion of some of the others I get in here."
"I like to drink a lot of water," I said. "Damaging the vigour of our race is the height of irresponsibility." Frau Elke snorted, engulfing the tiny room and the both of us in a massive cloud of powder.
"Sorry about that, hun," she said. "I'll clear it up in a jiffy."
Then she vacuumed away the cloud and cleaned the trousers of my uniform with a small suction device. As she was dusting off my hair, the door opened. In the mirror, I could see Ali Gagmez enter the room. He coughed.
"Is the smoke mortar part of the program?" he smirked.
"No," I said.
"It was my fault," Frau Elke said. "But we'll have him right as rain in no time."
I liked that. No prevaricating, no excuses, just an unswerving acknowledgement of one's errors and a promise to make amends for these autonomously. I never failed to find it gratifying that, over the past few decades, the German racial inheritance had not been fully swamped by the genetic soup of democracy.
"Excellent," Gagmez said, holding out his hand.
"I hear from Frau Bellini that you come out with these firecrackers. I'm Ali."
I worked my unpowdered hand out from under the smock and shook his. Tiny avalanches trickled from my hair.
"Pleased to meet you. Hitler."
"So, how's it going, mate? Everything okay?" "I think so, Frau Elke."
"I'm almost done, pet," Frau Elke said.
"Great uniform," Gagmez said. "It looks totally authentic. Where'd you pick up things like that?"
"Well, it's not that simple," I said, giving the matter some thought. "My most recent visits were usually to Josef Landolt in Munich."
"Landolt?" Gagmez pondered.
"Never heard of him. But Munich, that must be with ProSieben. They've got some ace costume designers."
"I expect he's retired in the meantime," I said.
"I can see it's going to work brilliantly, you with your Nazi piece and me, even though Nazi routines aren't exactly new."
"And?" I asked suspiciously.
"No, sure, it'll be great anyway," he said. "It always is. Not a problem, mate, everything's been done before. I picked up the foreigner routine in New York. It was all the rage in the 90s. Where'd you get your Führer thing from?
From the Germanic peoples, ultimately.
Gagmes laughed.
Bellini's right, you really carry your part through all the way.
Okay, mate, see you later. Do you need a cue? Should I start on a particular subject before I introduce you?
That is quite unnecessary, I said.
I couldn't do that, Gagmes said. You know, without any sort of script, I'll be up shit creek. But I've never really had much time for improvisation. Anyway, mate, later.
And he left the room.
In truth, I had been expecting further instructions. What now? I asked Frau Elke.
Fancy that, she laughed.
I thought the Führer would know which way to go. There is no need for arrogance, I rebuked her. As the Führer of the German Reich, my business is to conduct the affairs of state, not tuppenny tours.
With a snort, she swiftly removed the powder compact from the vicinity of her nose.
You're not getting me this time, she said, sounding somewhat cooler.
She pointed to a corner of the room.
See that? You can follow the programme on the screen. There's plenty of them around the place, in wardrobe and down in the canteen. Jenny will come to collect you, to be sure you make your entrance on time.
The programme was exactly as I had expected, given what I had already seen and heard of it. Gagmes introduced a few film snippets, in which he appeared as a Pole or a Turk, and translated their various shortcomings into stage routines. This man was no Charlie Chaplin, but in fact that was no bad thing. The audience gave his tomfoolery a sympathetic reception, and if one stretched the concept far enough, one might say that at least part of his performance had a political awareness at its core, which meant it was incontestable that what I had to say would fall on fertile soil. The handover was effected by means of a fixed phrase, uttered by Gagmes without further ado. And now, a topical piece from Adolf Hitler. And so, for the first time, I stepped out from the wings and into the glare of the spotlights. It was as if I were returning home to the Sportpalast after years of hardship in a foreign land. The heat from the lights burned into my skin. I could make out the youthful faces of the audience. There may have been several hundred of them, representing the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands, in front of their television sets. Here was the future of the Reich. Here were the people with which I was going to build my Germany. I could feel the tension within me, and the joy, too. If ever I had harbored doubts, these vanished in the rapture of this build-up. I was accustomed to speaking for hours on end. Now I had but 5 minutes. I stepped up to the lectern and stood there without saying a word. My gaze wandered from one side of the recording studio to the other. I listened to the silence, eager to discover whether decades of democracy had, as I expected, left behind little more than faint traces in these young minds. Laughter had erupted in the audience as my name was announced, but it quickly subsided. My physical presence unleashed a hush across the assembled crowd. From their expressions, I could see that they were trying to compare my countenance with the faces of professional performers more familiar to them. I could see the uncertainty triggered by nothing more than simple eye contact in that breathless silence. My concerns about heckling were unfounded. At each and every gathering in the Hofbraukeller, the reception had been more hostile. I moved forward and readied myself to speak, but then merely crossed my arms. At a stroke, the noise level dropped further by 100 times, 1,000 times even. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Gagmez, the dilettante, starting to sweat as he watched, apparently, nothing happening. I realized straight away that this man feared silence and knew nothing of its power. His eyebrows contorted into a grimace, as if I had forgotten my script. An assistant tried to give me a sign, tapping furiously on her wristwatch. I prolonged the silence even further by slowly raising my head. The tension in the room was palpable, as was Gagmas's anxiety. I enjoyed it. I let the air flow into my lungs, straightened up, and broke the silence with a barely audible sound. When everyone is listening for cannon fire, a falling pin can suffice. My fellow Germans, what we have just seen in numerous routines is perfectly true. It is true that the Turk has no creative genius, and nor will he ever have. True that he is a hawker, a peddler, a huckster, whose intellectual abilities will rarely surpass those of one of our kinsmen. True that the Indian is a garrulous type, befuddled by his religion. True that the relationship between the pole and property has been ruined for good. These are all general truths, manifest to every fellow German, man or woman, needing no further explanation. And yet, it is a disgrace to our nation that here, on German soil, only a Turkish follower of our movement dares to say these things out loud. My fellow Germans, looking at our country today, this comes as no surprise. Germans today keep their waste more thoroughly separated than their races, with one single exception in the field of humor. Here, only, the German makes jokes about Germans, the Turk makes jokes about Turks. The house mouse makes jokes about the house mouse, and the field mouse jokes about the field mouse. This has to change, and this will change. From today, at 22:45, the house mouse will joke about the field mouse, the badger about the deer, and the German about the Turk. And so, I concur fully with the criticism of foreigners expressed by the previous speaker. I stepped back. The silence was astounding. I marched off stage. Still no sound from the audience. Madame Bellini was whispering something into a colleague's ear. I stood beside her and observed the audience once more. People's eyes were deranged. Their gaze searched the stage for something to alight on, then darted back to the presenter's desk. Gagmas sat there, his mouth opening and closing like a puppet as he struggled to find a witty line with which to conclude the program. It was this conspicuous show of impotence which set off a volley of laughter in the audience. Not without some satisfaction, I watched his utter helplessness, which ultimately petered out in an indifferent, "Till next time, tune in again." Madame Bellini cleared her throat. She seemed uncertain, so I decided to reassure her. "I know what you're thinking," I told her. "Oh," she said, "do you now?" "Of course," I replied. "The same happened to me once. We had hired out the Circus Krone building, and it was not clear whether..." "Excuse me," Madame Bellini said. "That's my phone." She retired to a corner of the backstage area and put her mobile telephone to her ear. She did not appear to like what was being said. As I was trying to make out her expression, I felt a hand on my uniform. Gagmas was collaring me. His face had lost all of its earlier cheeriness. As he shoved me against the set and hissed at me through gritted teeth, I was once again made painfully aware of how much I missed my SS. "What do you think you're playing at, you stupid prick? You and your concurring with the previous speaker can fuck right off!"
Over his shoulder, I spotted some stewards rushing towards us. Gagmess pushed me against the wall again, then let go. His face was purple. Then he turned around and screamed.
What the fuck is going on here? I thought this asshole was going to do his Nazi shit.
He turned to hotel reserver Savatsky and, without lowering the volume, said,
Where is Carmen? Where is Carmen?
Pale but undiminished, Madame Bellini hurried over. I wondered whether I would be able to count on her loyalty, but could not reach a definitive conclusion. She waved her hands about in an effort to diffuse the situation and opened her mouth to say something, but no words came out.
At last, Carmen, that was one major fuck-up. Did you see it? Did you fucking well see it? Where did you dig up this asshole? You said I'd do my foreigner routine and he'd follow with his Nazi crap. You said he'd disagree with me. He'd get all uptight about Turks on the telly and that sort of shit. And now this! What the fuck do you mean by follower of our movement? What fucking movement? And how am I a follower? Where the fuck does that leave me?
I did tell you he was a bit different, Madame Bellini said. She had regained her composure with astonishing rapidity.
I don't give a fuck!
Gagmez frothed.
Let me tell you right here, I want this fucker off my program now. He doesn't stick to his agreements. I'm having this arsehole shit all over my program and ruin it.
Calm down, Madame Bellini said in a curious tone which was at once soft and energetic. It didn't go that badly.
Is everything okay?
One of the two stewards inquired.
Absolutely fine, Madame Bellini said, reassuring him. I've got it all under control. Calm down, Ali.
I'm not going to fucking well calm down!
Gagmez howled, and then dug his index finger under my shoulder strap.
You are not going to fuck me over, matey,
he said, hammering repeatedly on my chest with his finger like a woodpecker.
You think you can just swan up here with your ridiculous Hitler uniform and your oh-so-fucking-inscrutable manner? But let me tell you, it's nothing new. It's old fucking hat. You're an amateur. What the fuck do you think you're doing here? You turn up and think you've got it all sewn up, but you're not going anywhere, matey. You can fucking kiss this one goodbye. If there is anyone who's got followers, it's me. This is my audience. Those are my fans. Keep your filthy little hands off. You are a pathetic amateur. Your uniform and your routine is all a heap of shit. With that toss, you might be able to do the old beer tent or rifle club, but let me tell you, you are never going to be anybody.
I have no need, I said calmly. Behind me are millions of fellow Germans who...
Cut the crap!
Gagmez shrieked.
You're not on the fucking telly now! Do you think you can wind me up? You are not going to wind me up! Not me!
Cool it, both of you, Bellini said, now raising her voice.
Sure, we need to work at it a bit. There's still a little fine-tuning to be done, but it wasn't that bad. Just something new. Now, let's all calm down and wait and see what the critics say.
If I had ever felt certain of my calling since my reappearance in this modern epoch, it was at this moment. Chapter 15. It is in times of crisis that the true Führer is revealed. When he shows his nerve, persistence, and sheer determination, though the world be set against him. If I had not been at Germany's helm, nobody would have marched into the Rhineland in 1936. They were all quivering in their boots. There was nothing we could have done if the enemy had decided to attack. We had 5 divisions at the ready. The French alone had 6 times as many. And yet I risked it. Nobody else would have dared. And at the time, I watched carefully to see who was standing by me, with their feet or their heart, side by side, sword in hand. It is also in those times of crisis that destiny reveals the true loyalists. Those moments of doubt when a hazardous venture gives rise to success if, but only if, the fanatical belief remains unbroken. The occasions when one can identify those who lack this belief, but who watch the situation unfold in uneasy expectation to determine on which side they should fight. A Führer
must keep a close eye on these people. Although they can be manipulated, one must never make the success of the movement dependent on them. Sensenbrink was one of their ilk. Sensenbrink was wearing what these days would probably be called a high-quality suit. He was trying to look casual, but I could see that he was pale. His face exhibited the pallor of a gambler who knows that he cannot suffer a loss, or, worse still, he cannot bear the moment in which it becomes obvious that his loss is inevitable. Such people never focus on their own goal. They always elect to pursue the goal which promises the most rapid success, and yet fail to recognize that this success will never be their own. They hope to achieve success, but they will only ever chaperone it. And because they sense this, they fear the moment of defeat, when it becomes manifest that not only is the success not their own, but it is not even dependent on their chaperoning. Sensenbrink was anxious about his reputation, not the national cause. It was patently clear that Sensenbrink would never shed blood for Germany or me in a hail of bullets outside the beer hall in Munich. On the contrary, how winsomely he consorted with Madame Bellini. Anyone with half an eye could see that, in spite of all his puffed-up self-confidence, he was the one hoping for her moral support. This came as no surprise. In my life, I have met four dominant women. Women who would be unthinkable as a choice of partner. Let us say you have Mussolini or Antonescu over for a visit. If you then tell one of these women to go into the room next door and not come back until invited to, you need to be sure that this is what is going to happen. Eva did it, but I could never have asked it of any of those four. Leni Riefenstahl was one of them, a wonderful woman. But if I had made such a request to Leni, she would have smashed me over the head with her camera. And Madame Bellini was of the same caliber as this venerable quartet. I do not think that anyone besides me noticed how she, too, was aware of the significance of these hours, these minutes. But, my goodness, this fantastic woman had exceptional control. I noticed she inhaled a touch more deeply on her cigarette than usual, but that was all. She held her wiry, lithe body upright. She was attentive, always prepared to offer helpful instructions, and her reactions were precise and rapid, like a skulking wolf. And not a single grey hair. Perhaps she was even younger than I had thought, late 30s. A truly magnificent specimen of womanhood. I also intuited that she found the sudden proximity of Sensenbrink disagreeable. Not because she found him bothersome, no, but because she despised his unmanliness, because she sensed that rather than putting all his strength at her disposal, he was draining her of energy. I felt an enormous urge to ask her how she was planning to spend the evening, and, with a certain melancholy, I suddenly recalled those evenings on the Obersalzberg. Many a time we would sit up long into the night, three, four, five of us. Sometimes I would talk, sometimes not. In fact, sometimes hours would pass in silence, interrupted only by the occasional cough. At other times I would just stroke the dog. I always found these gatherings rather conducive to contemplation. Things are not always easy. The Führer is one of the few people in the state who has to forego the simple pleasures of normal family life. And life in a hotel like mine was rather lonely. This was one of the aspects of my existence which had changed least over the last 60 years. Then it occurred to me that in my situation I really ought to ask Madame Bellini, but somehow this felt inappropriate, too familiar, especially as we had not known each other long. I decided to push the thought to the back of my mind. On the other hand, I felt it would only be fitting to have a small celebration to mark my return to public life. Just a glass of sparkling wine or something similar. Not for me, of course, but I always enjoyed being in the company of others in high spirits who raised a toast. My gaze alighted on Hotel Reserva Savatsky. His eyes beamed at me,
They were full of unmistakable esteem. I knew this look, one which should not be interpreted the wrong way. Savatsky was not one of those men in an SA shirt, whom one drags from Röhm's bed in the night and then into whose repulsive body one fires a few bullets in disgust, saving the fatal one until last. No. Savatsky looked at me with a sort of silent reverence, which I had last witnessed in Nuremberg in those hundreds of thousands to whom I had offered hope, who had grown up in a world of humiliations and fear for the future, a world of procrastinating windbags and war losers, who in me saw the firm hand which would lead them, and who were willing to follow me. "So," I said, wandering over to Savatsky, "did you enjoy it?"
"Unbelievable," Savatsky said. "Really impressive. I've seen Ingvar Appelt, but he's lame compared to you. You've got balls. Do you really not care what people think of you?"
"On the contrary, young man," I said, "I will speak the truth, and they should think, here is someone who speaks the truth."
"And? Is that what they're thinking now?"
"No, but they are thinking in a different way from before, and that is all one needs to achieve. Continual repetition will see to the rest."
"Yeah," Savatsky said. "But the repeat's on Sunday morning at 11, so I don't reckon that'll make much of a splash."
I gave him a blank look. Savatsky cleared his throat, then said,
"Follow me. We've arranged a little something in the canteen."
We walked over to where a handful of television employees were hanging about looking bored. A slovenly-looking lad turned to me with his mouth full and laughed out loud. Then he coughed and gave a passable Nazi salute. I jerked my arm back in response and let Savatsky guide me to an area of the canteen where Sekt was waiting for us. Judging by Savatsky's reaction, it was a highly sophisticated product. He instructed a canteen assistant to prepare two glasses, remarking that this sort of sparkling wine was not something they laid on every day.
"Gagmes doesn't get that served up to him often," the assistant said.
Savatsky laughed, handed me my glass, raised his and said,
"Here's to you."
"To Germany," I said. Then we clinked glasses and drank.
"What's wrong?" Savatsky asked apprehensively. "Doesn't it taste good?"
"If I drink wine at all, it is usually a dessert variety, like a Trockenbierauslese," I explained. "I know it's supposed to have this bitter note. Indeed, in this wine it is deemed an advantage, but I'm afraid it's too acidic for me."
"I can get you something else."
"No, don't worry. I'm used to it."
"But you could have a Bellini."
"Bellini? Like Madame?"
"Yes, of course. You might like that. Wait a sec."
While Savatsky skipped off, I stood there uncertainly. For a moment, I thought of all those dreadful times in my early years of politics, at the beginning of my struggle, before I had been properly introduced into society, and felt somewhat lost at its periphery. This unpleasant memory only lasted for a fraction of a second, however, for no sooner had Savatsky turned away than a young brunette approached me and said,
"That was fantastic. How'd you come up with something like the House Mouse and Field Mouse?"
"You could do the same," I said confidently. "All you need to do is take a walk through nature and keep your eyes open. Alas, many Germans these days have forgotten how to see the simple things. May I ask what education you have?"
"I'm still studying," she said. "Sinology, theatre studies and..."
"Good God!" I laughed. "Stop at once! A pretty thing like you, stuffed full of such cerebral nonsense? You would be far better off finding yourself a brave young husband and doing something to help preserve the German race." She laughed heartily. "That's method acting, isn't it?" "There he is!" Madame Bellini called out behind me. At her side was Sensenbrink, with Gagmez in tow, a tortured smile on his lips. They joined us.
"Let's toast. We're all professionals here, and the professional in us can't help but conclude that this was a fabulous program, There's never been anything like it. You two are going to be a dream ticket.
Sensenbrink eagerly filled glasses with sparkling wine, while Savatsky returned and handed me a glass of something the colour of apricots.
What is this? Just tried, he said, raising his glass. Guys, to the Führer!
To the Führer! There was sympathetic and jubilant laughter all around, and I had a keen struggle to fend off all the congratulations offered to me.
Please, ladies and gentlemen, we still have much work to do.
Cautiously, I took a sip of the drink and gave Herr Savatsky an appreciative nod. It tasted very fruity, was a delight to the palate, and yet was not of such overblown complexity. Essentially, it seemed to be a simple country-style fruit pulp, enlivened by a little sect. But only a drop, so that, having enjoyed the drink, one need not fear excessive hiccuping or similar aggravations. The significance of such details is not to be underestimated. In a situation like mine, one must always take care to behave impeccably. What I find disagreeable about these informal yet important gatherings is that one cannot simply retire when one would like, unless one is waging war at the same time. If one is busy executing the Manstein Plan in northern France, or if one is launching a surprise attack to occupy Norway, then everybody is full of understanding, quite naturally. As they are if one retires to one's study after the toast to look over U-boat designs or help develop high-speed bombers crucial to our final victory. In peacetime, however, one just stands around, wasting one's time drinking fruit pulp. Sensenbrink's raucous manner was increasingly testing my nerves, while Gagmez's sour face did not make the evening any more congenial. So I excused myself, temporarily at least, to fetch myself something from the buffet. An assortment of sausages was being served in heated rectangular tin vessels, as well as an array of roast meats and large quantities of noodles, none of which particularly appealed to me. I was about to turn away when Savatsky appeared at my side.
Is there something I can get you?
No, don't worry.
Damn it, Savatsky said, slapping his forehead.
You're looking for the stew, aren't you?
No, I can take one of these sandwiches.
But you prefer stew, wouldn't you? The Führer loves simple food.
That would indeed be my choice, I admitted, or something without meat.
I'm really sorry we didn't catch on early enough, he said. I should have thought, but if you wait a moment...
He pulled out his mobile telephone and tapped at it with his fingers. Can your telephone cook too?
No, he said. But 10 minutes from here, there's a restaurant which is well known for its honest fare and stews. If you like, I can order something from there.
Please refrain from going to any trouble. I quite fancy a bit of a stroll anyway, I said. I can have the stew there.
If you don't mind, I'll take you there myself, Savatsky said. It's not far.
We absconded from the party and walked through the chilly Berlin night. This was far more agreeable than standing around in that canteen where an entire division of broadcasting types were incessantly lavishing praise on each other. Every so often, our feet kicked up a few leaves.
Can I ask you something? Savatsky said.
Please do.
Is it a coincidence? I mean, that you're a vegetarian too.
Absolutely not, I said. It's common sense. I have been one for so long it was only a matter of time before others shared my conviction. It's just those buffet cooks who don't seem to have heard of it.
No, what I meant was, have you always been one, or only since you became Hitler?
I have always been Hitler. Who do you imagine I was before that?
Well, maybe you tried a few others first, Churchill or Honecker.
Himmler believed in all that esoteric humbug, reincarnation and mysticism. I can assure you I was never that Honecker fellow. Savatsky looked at me.
And don't you ever think you take your art too far?
One must undertake everything with utter fanatical determination, or one will get nowhere.
But just to take an example,
no one would notice whether you were really a vegetarian or not.
First, I said, it is a question of well-being. And second, there can be no doubt that this is the way nature desires it. Look, a lion can run 2 or 3 kilometres before it is completely exhausted. 20 minutes, not even. 1/4 hour. A camel, on the other hand, can keep going for 1 week. It's the food which does that.
A nice example of sophistry.
I stopped and glared at him.
What do you mean, sophistry?
Right, let's put it another way, then. Where is Stalin?
Dead, I'd say.
I see. And Roosevelt?
Same.
Pétain, Eisenhower, Antonescu, Horthy?
The first two are dead, and I haven't heard of the others.
Well, they're dead too. And what about me?
You're not dead.
Precisely, I said with satisfaction, and set off again. And I am convinced that this is because I'm a vegetarian.
Savatsky laughed. Then he caught me up.
That's really good. Don't you write that sort of stuff down?
Why bother? I know it.
I'm always worried that I'll forget these things, he said, pointing to the door of a restaurant. Here we are.
We entered the half-empty restaurant and placed our order with an elderly waitress. She gave me a hard stare and then screwed up her face in confusion. Savatsky gave her a reassuring wave, and the lady went to fetch the drinks without further ado.
It's nice here, I said. It reminds me of the time of my struggle in Munich.
Do you come from Munich?
No, from Linz, or actually
from Braunau, Savatsky said.
I've been doing a bit of reading up.
Where do you come from? I asked him in return. And how old are you, by the way? You cannot be 30 yet.
27, Savatsky said. I come from Bonn, and I studied in Cologne.
A Rhinelander, I said with delight, and an educated Rhinelander to boot.
German and history. In fact, I wanted to be a journalist.
It's a good thing you aren't one, I asserted. Lying vermin, through and through.
Well, the TV industry isn't much better, he said. It's unbelievable, the crap they churn out. And whenever we get hold of anything good, the stations would rather have another pile of crap, or something cheaper, or both.
Without pausing, he added, apart from you, of course, what you do is completely different.
For the first time, I get the feeling that we're not just flogging any old rubbish. I love your approach. The vegetarianism and everything. You're not faking it. Somehow with you, it's part of the whole concept.
I prefer the term ideology, I said, but I was overjoyed by his youthful enthusiasm.
You know, this has been something I've always wanted to do, Savatsky said. Not just tout any old thing, but something of quality. At Flashlight, we have to peddle so much garbage.
Listen, when I was a boy, I always wanted to work in an animal sanctuary, help poor animals, that sort of thing, or save animals, do something positive.
The waitress placed 2 bowls of stew before us. I was quite touched. The stew looked excellent, and it smelled as a stew ought to.
We began to eat, and for a while neither of us said a word.
Good?
Savatsky asked.
Very good, I said, spooning it from the bowl, as if it were straight from the field mess.
Yes, he said. There's something about it. Simple, but good.
Are you married? He shook his head. Engaged?
No, he said. More like interested. There is someone.
But?
She doesn't have a clue. And I don't know if she's interested in me either.
You must be bold, and go all out for total victory. You are not shy otherwise.
Sure, but she...
No wavering. Onward, quick march. Women's hearts are like battles. They are not won through hesitation. One must concentrate all one's forces and deploy them gallantly.
Is that how you got to know your wife?
Well, I could never complain about a lack of female interest, but my approach was generally the other way around.
The other way around?
In the later years especially, I won more battles than women.
He laughed.
If you're not going to write it down, I will. If you go on in this vein, you really should think about writing a book.
Hitler's How-To Book, How to Have a Happy Relationship.
I'm not sure that is my calling, I said. I mean, my marriage was rather short.
So I've heard, but that doesn't matter.
We'll call it Mein Kampf with my wife.
With a title like that, it would sell like hotcakes. I had to laugh, too.
I looked pensively at Savatsky, his short hair sticking up cheekily, his alert expression, his buoyant but by no means foolish words. And in his voice I perceived that this man could have been one of those who accompanied me back then, to prison, to the Reich Chancellery, to the Führerbunker.
Chapter 16. Ah, Herr Hitler, I've been expecting you,
the newspaper seller said in an enigmatically theatrical voice.
Really?
I said, amused. Why?
Well, I saw your performance, he said, and then I reckoned you'd want to read what's been written about you,
and that you might look for a place where the selection of papers and magazines is, how should I put it, a little broader? Come in, take a seat. Would you like a coffee?
What's wrong? Don't you feel well? I found it disconcerting that he had spotted this minor weakness in me, and it really was a minor weakness, a surge of joy, the lack of which I had not experienced in a long time. I had woken as fresh as a daisy at around 11:30, partaken of a small breakfast, and then decided to read the newspapers, just as the vendor had guessed. 2 days previously, my suits had been delivered, allowing me something somewhat less official to slip into. The one I was now wearing was simple, dark, and traditionally cut, and I had chosen to pair it with the dark hat. As I set off from the hotel, I could see at once that I was attracting many fewer glances than usual. It was a crystal clear, sunny day and wonderfully fresh, as one might expect for the time of year. For now, I felt free of all obligations, and I marched forth with a sense of purpose. It was so peaceful. It almost felt normal, and because I took the green route along footpaths and through parks, there was little to grab my attention, save for a mad woman who was bending down, obviously trying to pinpoint and then gather up her spaniel's excrement in the long unmown grass. It struck me briefly that this lunacy might be the result of an epidemic, but nobody appeared to be surprised by what she was doing. On the contrary, as I discovered soon afterwards, dispensing machines had been thoughtfully installed here and there, from which these mad women were able to draw lots of small bags. The provisional conclusion I reached was that these must be women whose fervent wish to have a child had remained unfulfilled, giving rise to a form of hysteria, which presented itself in this disproportionate care for all manner of dogs. And I had to concede that providing the poor creatures with bags was an astonishingly pragmatic solution. In the longer term, of course, these women ought to be steered back to their proper duties, but I expect that some party or other had opposed this. It's all too familiar. My mind full of these less than demanding deliberations, I walked uninterrupted to the kiosk. Indeed, I was scarcely recognized at all. The situation felt curiously familiar, but it was not until I heard the words of the newspaper seller that I understood why. It was that magical atmosphere I had frequently experienced in those early days in Munich after my release from prison. I was fairly well known in the city, but at the time I was still a minor party chairman, a speaker who could see into people's hearts. And it was the little people, the littlest people, who, touchingly, lent me their support. I would cross the Viktualienmarkt
where the poorest of the market women would smile and beckon me over, offering me a couple of eggs or a pound of apples. I went home like a veritable forager, to be greeted by a beaming landlady. Their faces used to radiate the same pure joy that I recognize now in the newspaper vendor. This impression of the past washed over me so quickly, before I could even grasp what it was. It was so overwhelming that I had to look away hurriedly. But on account of his long professional experience, the newspaper seller had acquired an impressive understanding of his fellow man, such as one might otherwise only find in motor cab drivers. I let out an embarrassed cough and said, "No coffee for me, thank you, but I'd love a cup of tea or a glass of water."
"Your wish is my command," he said, filling a kettle like the one in my hotel room.
"I'll put the papers by your chair. There aren't many of them. I think the internet's the best place to look."
"Yes, this internet work," I said in agreement.
"A splendid facility. And nor do I believe that my success will be dependent on the goodwill of the newspapers." "I don't want to spoil your enjoyment," the newspaper seller said, fetching a tea bag from a shelf. "But there's no need to worry. Those who saw it seem to like you." "I have no worries," I said confidently. "What is the opinion of a critic worth?"
"Well, nothing," I said.
"Nothing at all. It counted for nothing in the 30s and it counts for nothing now. All they ever do is tell people what to think. The wholesome sensibility of the folk is in no way inferior. Indeed, the folk instinctively know what to think, even without our noble critics. A wholesome folk has a perfectly clear sense of what is good and what is not. Does the farmer need a critic to tell him how good the soil is in which he cultivates his wheat? No, the farmer himself knows better."
"Because he sees his fields every day," the newspaper seller chirped in.
"But he doesn't see you every day."
"But he does see his television set every day, so he can make his own judgments. No, the German needs no one to draft opinions for him. He forms his own opinion."
"Well, you should know," he said with a grin, offering me the sugar. "I mean, you're the expert on forming one's own opinions."
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"I really have to watch out with you," the newspaper seller said, shaking his head. "I can't help talking to you as if you really were him."
A hand rapped on the sales counter behind him.
"I've got customers. Have a read of what the papers say. There's not that much."
I looked at the small pile by the chair. I did not feature on their front pages, but I couldn't have supposed that would be the case. Nor had any of the major newspapers addressed the topic. For example, that formidable Bild was not amongst the pile. Seeing as Gagmess's programme had been running for a while now, the press were probably no longer all that interested. In the end, it was only covered by the smaller regional papers, which commissioned writers to watch the television set every day in order to compile a short column. Three of these writers had switched on to the programme, hoping to be entertained, and all were of the opinion that my speech had been the most noteworthy feature. One found it astonishing that, of all people, it was a Hitler figure who had identified exactly what Gagmess was serving up every week, a mass of clichés about foreigners. The other two said that, thanks to my splendidly wicked performance, Gagmess had finally rediscovered his edge, which had been missing for far too long. "So?" the newspaper seller said. "Happy?" "I started from the very bottom once before," I said, sipping my tea. "Back then I spoke to an audience of 20. I suspect a third of them had come by accident. No, I cannot complain. I must look to the future." "How did you find it?"
"Good," he said. "Hardcore, but good. Gagmess didn't look too thrilled, though."
"Indeed," I said. "It's something I have come across before. Those drunk on success always cry foul whenever a fresh idea makes its mark. At once they start fretting about their livelihood."
"Is he going to let you back on his programme?"
He will do whatever the production company tells him. He lives off the system. He must follow its rules.
I can hardly believe it's only been a few weeks since I picked you up off the ground outside my kiosk,
the newspaper vendor said.
The rules are the same as they were 60 years ago, I said. They never change. The only difference is that there are fewer Jews to worry about, and so the folk is in better shape.
By the way, I haven't thanked you properly. Did they...
Don't worry,
the newspaper seller said.
We came to an agreement. I've been looked after. Then his portable telephone rang. He lifted the device to his ear. I picked up a copy of Bild and leafed through it. The newspaper projected a combination of anger and hatred, starting with reports of political ineptitude and building a picture of a clueless but ultimately benign matron chancellor, shuffling awkwardly through a horde of obstructive dwarfs. Meanwhile, virtually every political decision, legitimated by democracy, was debunked as poppycock. This admirable smear sheet reserved a special venom for the idea of European Union, which it found utterly repellent. But what I liked best of all was its subtle mode of operation. For example, I found the following in a humorous column between jokes about mothers-in-law and cuckolded husbands. A Portuguese, a Greek, and a Spaniard go into a brothel. Who pays?
Germany.
Very, very funny. Of course, Stryker would have commissioned a drawing to accompany it, portraying three unshaven, oily southerners pawing at an innocent little thing, while the honest German worker grafts away in the background. On balance, however, that would have spoiled the joke's subtlety. Otherwise, a colourful hodgepodge of criminal tales filled the pages, followed by that category of reporting which has always been the most effective form of appeasement, sport. And then a collection of photographs showing famous people looking ancient or ugly, a full-blown symphony of envy, resentment, and malice. For this very reason, I would have been pleased if a brief notice of my appearance had found its way into these pages. But the newspaper seller had been correct not to include Bild in his pile. It made no mention of me. I lowered the paper when he put his telephone away. That was my son, he said. The one whose shoes you didn't like? He asked whether you were the bloke from my kiosk. He saw you on his mate's mobile. He said you were absolutely unreal. I looked at the newspaper vendor blankly. He thinks you're brilliant, the man translated. I dread to think what kinds of films they've got on their mobiles, but you can be sure they don't watch anything they find dull. The sensibilities of young people are unadulterated, I declared. For them there is no good or bad, they merely think instinctively. If a child is raised correctly, he will never come to make a bad decision. Do you have children?
Unfortunately not, I said. I mean, rumours were occasionally spread by those with an interest in the matter that there were some off the record, as we say in our neck of the woods.
I get it, the newspaper seller said cheerfully, lighting a cigarette.
Was it a question of maintenance, then?
No. They wanted to ruin me, turn me into a laughingstock. Since when has it been wrong or dishonourable to give a child the gift of life?
Try telling that to the ultra-conservatives.
Agreed. One must always take the simple people into account. You can concoct whatever arguments you like, but for many people it will be one step too far. Himmler tried it once in the SS. He wanted to institute the same rights for legitimate and illegitimate children, but it didn't work, not even there.
Regrettably so. The poor children, small boys, little girls, they suffer disapproving glances, they get teased. The other children dance around them, singing cruel songs. And this is damaging to the national spirit, the sense of community. We are all of us Germans, the legitimate as well as the illegitimate. I always say, children are children, whether in the cot or in the trenches. Of course, one must provide for them. But only the most despicable Schweinhund would do a runner.
I put Bild back in its rack.
So, how did it end up?
Nothing. It was pure slander, of course, and nothing ever came of it.
There you go, the newspaper seller said, sipping his tea.
I have no idea whether the Gestapo took the matter in hand at any stage, but I'm sure that won't be necessary any more.
Probably not. I mean, you brought the press into line, didn't you?
He said, laughing as if he had cracked a joke.
Precisely, I nodded.
Then the Ride of the Valkyries rang out. Fraulein Kurmeier had set it up for me. After we brought the computer into service, we established that the quartermaster had also supplied me with one of those portable telephones. The device was an unbelievable affair. Moreover, one could use it to navigate this internetwork, and even more efficiently than with the mouse tool. One steered with one's fingers. I realized at once that I held in my hands a masterpiece of Aryan creative genius, and all it took was a few swipes of the finger to discover that, of course, the superlative Siemens company had been responsible for the technology which brought this miracle to pass. Fräulein Kurmeier had to undertake the finger movements for me, as I was unable to decrypt the visual display without spectacles. I wanted to sign the whole thing over to her. After all, the Führer cannot concern himself with too much bric-a-brac. That is what the Secretariat is for. Quite correctly, however, she reminded me that I could only be reliant on her labour for half of each day. I rebuked myself for having become too dependent on my party machine. Finding myself again at square one, I would have to confront this contraption myself, for better or for worse.
"Any particular ringtone?"
Fraulein Kurmeier had asked me.
"Certainly not," I replied sardonically. "After all, I don't work in an open-plan office."
"So I'll just give you, like, the normal one?"
I then heard a noise which sounded like a drunken clown playing the xylophone over and over again.
"What the devil is that?" I asked, horrified.
"That's your phone?"
Fräulein Kurmeier said, adding, "Mein Führer? And it sounds like that?"
"Only when it rings?"
"Switch it off. I don't want people taking me for an imbecile."
"That's why I asked you," Fräulein Kurmeier said. "Do you prefer this one?"
More clowns playing diverse instruments.
"That's appalling," I groaned.
"But I thought you didn't care what people thought of you."
"My dear Fräulein Kurmeier," I said, "personally, I consider short lederhosen to be the most masculine trousers a man can wear. And when, one day, I am once again commander-in-chief of the Wehrmacht, I will supply an entire division with these short trousers and woolen stockings." At this point, Fräulein Kurmeier made an outlandish noise and wiped her nose. "I know," I continued, "you do not hail from southern Germany. You cannot understand my way of thinking. Just wait until this division is standing there, on parade. Then it will become clear that all those jokes about leather shorts are baseless. But, and now I am coming to the point, on my path to power, I was forced to acknowledge that industrialists and statesmen do not take politicians in these trousers seriously. It is one of my greatest regrets to have abandoned the short trousers. But I did it because it served my cause, and thus the cause of the German folk. And let me tell you, I did not relinquish these wonderful trousers only for a telephone set to render my sacrifice worthless and leave me looking like a total moron. So don't just stand there. Find me a sensible ring."
"That's why I, like, asked you?"
Fräulein Kurmeier sniffed, putting away her handkerchief.
"I can leave it so it's like a normal phone, but I can get you any other sound you like words, sounds, music."
"Music too?"
"If I don't have to play it myself, it would have to be like on a record."
So then she set up the Ride of the Valkyries for me.
Good, isn't it? I said to the newspaper seller, confidently raising the device to my ear. Hitler here! I could hear nothing but Valkyries riding forth. Hitler! I said. Hitler here! And when the Valkyries continued to ride, I tried, Führer headquarters! Just in case the caller was in shock at having got through to me personally. Nothing happened, save for the Valkyries getting louder. By now my ear was truly hurting.
Hitler here!
I screamed.
Führer headquarters!
It felt as if I were back on the Western Front in 1915.
Press the green button,
the newspaper seller said plaintively.
I can't stand Wagner.
Which green button?
That thing on your phone, he cried. You have to swipe it to the right.
I looked at the machine, where indeed I could see a green slider. I pushed it to the right, the Valkyries fell silent, and I shouted,
Hitler here! Führer headquarters!
Nothing. The newspaper vendor rose.